Tonight on Arena, Chris Walser delves into the history of the Targaryens in the House of the Dragon, and we look at the art of storytelling in Kerry. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. The bloody push and pull over who would occupy the Iron Throne kept audiences enthralled over the 8 seasons of George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones. The political intrigue, sex and violence, and a willingness to kill off even the most crucial of characters made the show a global hit for HBO and created its own tourism industry in Northern Ireland. Well, Winterway may not be coming yet, but HBO are going back to that well once more with House of the Dragon, which hits our TV screens on Monday. It's a prequel to Game of Thrones, set a very precise 172 years before the birth of Daenerys Targaryen, the mother of dragons. This new iteration of the story stars Matt Smith and Paddy Considine as Daenerys's ancestors, who are locked in their own power struggle. Chris Walser has been watching the series, which was estimated to cost $200 million. But before we talk to Chris, let's hear a clip from House of the Dragon. This is Matt Smith, who was formerly Doctor Who, formerly Prince Philip, now playing Daemon Targaryen.
Gods. Kings. Fire. And blood. Dreams didn't make us kings. Dragons did.
So the dragons are back, Chris. Tell us a little bit of where we're 172 years before Daenerys. So
yes.
Tell us about the House of the Targaryens. Are they in good stead? Have they got power?
Well, it's sort of the beginning of a long end for the Targaryens at this stage of the story. And for Game of Thrones fans who maybe aren't familiar with the source material, this is actually based on George R.R. Martin's Fire and Blood, which acted as a sort of, for George R.R. Martin, a stopgap when he should have been, you know, writing the final couple of novels in the Game of Thrones series and in the Song of Ice and Fire series. And it's a sort of a historical fiction account of, you know, the fall of the Targaryen Empire set 300 years beforehand. But this series picks up 172 years, as you say at the top, before the birth of Daenerys Targaryen, who was portrayed, of course, by Emilia Clarke in Game of Thrones. And we are at a crossing, you know, we're at a point in the Targaryen history where the announcement of the unveiling of a new king will kind of lead to this downfall, which will eventually lead to a civil war. And the House Targaryen family, they meet to elect to announce this new ruler, who is Viserys, played by Paddy Considine. And unlike, you know, his predecessors, he's not an entirely likable sort, and he's sort of a reluctant king as well. His family actually picks him over his cousin, who's female, because, you know, their attitude is that they couldn't possibly have a female be their ruler. They have to have a king. And you think Viserys is going to be, you know, a very honest type, a different, you know, he's not power hungry. He's just kind of, look, I have this job and I will try to do my best with it. And we sort of fast forward in the first installment, you know, a few years to see how he's getting on. And as you say at the top there as well, there is this power struggle. You know, people didn't want Viserys to be king. He didn't really want himself to be king. He has his younger brother, Daemon, who is a bit of a hothead, you know, and you cannot trust him. He's quite sadistic. He's violent. You know, he's got this, you know, penchant for anarchy. You have his hand, Otto Highwarder, played by Rhys Ifans, who himself, you know, is kind of eyeing up the role potentially. And you also have this problem that Viserys's wife hasn't provided him with a male heir, and it's all Viserys thinks about. You know, they have their daughter Rhaenyra. She's a dragon rider who is not entirely unlike, you know, Emilia Clarke's Daenerys, who will come along 200 years later. But the big problem is, who will be Viserys's heir after he's gone?
Okay, and there are problems when his wife is hoping to have a boy yes. child and heir, which and this, of course, if he doesn't have a boy child, the next likely successor is this hot-headed brother. But the hot-headed brother has is pretty gruesome and pretty violent. And in fact, they've put him the head of a group called Vigilantes, called the City Watch, really because he's failed at everything else.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and in an act of just the outrageous, you know, this outrageous exhibition of violence, we get to see Damon take the City Watch out one night to kind of prove to the people of King's Landing, to kind of remind them of who's in charge. And one by one, they pick up, you know, thieves and murderers and rapists, and they publicly dismember and maim and butcher them. And it's an act of violence that kind of comes out of nowhere, because at the beginning of this series, the first sign that we're dealing with something very different from Game of Thrones is that, you know, it's very inward looking, it's quite intimate, it's quite insular. In Game of Thrones, we had all of these different families. Sometimes there were, you know, half a dozen or maybe a dozen subplots going on at once over an entire series, where if you, for a viewer, if you weren't interested in what one family was doing, you know, wait 5 minutes, the next one will be along. And, you know, everyone had their different favorite characters. With this, it's all about the Targaryens. And so to save the series from basically being the Targaryen family sitting around, or the king sitting with his council discussing who the heir will be, every now and then we kind of have this huge spectacle of violence, and Daemon bringing out his City Watch men to enact, you know, a sort of a vengeance on the people of King's Landing. This is the first this is the first kind of, you know, violent sequence of this series, and it is quite shocking.
I must say, Chris, it was a relief to have a simpler storyline and to be based just in one location, because it was pretty challenging. If you missed an episode of Game of Thrones, you wouldn't know where you were.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I mean, Game of Thrones was a sprawling piece of work. You know, I was a fan of it. I was never quite a fan of it the way other people are, in that, you know, it is often considered now in the years since it finished, well, probably before its finale, which just dampened everyone's spirits, the cast and the makers included. It worked quite well, you know, but you had to lean into it. It was a very simple story, but you know, I think it was the dialogue. I think it was the number of characters involved made it a little bit tricky, but it was quite, you know, it was quite fantastical. It was quite fizzy. It worked as a sort of a swords and dragon adventure, but it also worked as this, you know, lean and engaging political thriller. And I think it's towards the latter that Ryan Condal and George R.R. Martin, both of whom have they co-created and developed the series. I mean, Martin's actually again taking time out from finishing the Game of Thrones, you know, the novels, to work on this series. I think they're kind of, you know, they're keen to kind of make this a little bit tighter. That works to its benefit in terms of, okay, we've only got one story to follow here, but where the cons start to come into it is that you have various characters just repeating the same thing over and over again, which is that Viserys needs a male lead. Rhaenyra does not want to, you know, rightfully kicks back against the life that's expected of her, which is, you know, she wants to be a warrior like the males in her family. She wants to be a ruler, but, you know, she's just expected to stay quiet and to, you know, to marry and to bear children. You have the fact that Daemon wants to be a ruler himself. It's a little bit repetitive, and I think
there
that could
start
to become...
There are great set pieces, though, Chris, aren't there? You were talking about when he goes out with the... Daemon goes out with his City Watch. That's pretty gruesome. Then there's a fantastic jousting scene, and you see a lot of jousting scene in old historic movies, but this is really down there and visceral.
Yes, and it is quite well done. I mean, there are parts of the first installment that are very well directed. You know, we have kind of like some Game of Thrones veterans coming back in to direct and to produce the show. And, you know, in terms of spectacle, okay, the jousting scene does work quite well. But I think a problem that I had with it was that in Game of Thrones, you know, memorably filmed in Northern Ireland and in Croatia, and the scenery and the setting was as much, you know, it was almost, you know, you would watch this show for the scenery as well as for the characters and for the dialogues, and it looked amazing. While I was watching House of the Dragon, I was never not aware that I was watching actors on a film set. And I think an awful lot of that has to do with the fact that, yes, it's a smaller story, but also that for the first time, you know, Game of Thrones was actually taken to this virtual set in England. And it was also filmed, you know, in parts of Cornwall. And later on in the series, I think we're going to see parts of Spain and California where production also took place. But certainly for the first episode, it just felt that little bit smaller, and that, you know, okay, this feels like I'm watching actors on a stage. And as well as that, I think the first episode tries to do a little bit too much. And if you recall, all in the jousting scene. We cross over then to this birthing scene, which is quite horrific, which is actually quite gruesome, where, you know, Viserys's wife, she is in labor, but of course, without spoiling things, let's just say just things start to go a little bit wrong there. And so it felt sometimes as though Condal and Aura Martin and everyone else involved, they couldn't help themselves, that it's not enough to have this violent and remarkable jousting scene. We're also going to throw in this violent and tragic childbirth as well. So it sometimes felt as though it was trying to do too many things at once.
Matt Smith as Daemon and Paddy Considine as the brother, the king, are two very strong leads, aren't they? To bring us into some of the women's parts then. The two young friends, the daughter and her friend, who would be the Rhys Evans's daughters.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think Matt Smith works a lot better as Daemon than Paddy Considine as the king. And I think Matt Smith, you know, he does deliver this, you know, deliciously twisted, dark portrayal. You know, I believed him as the brother, and he was also believably frightening. That says, you know, he doesn't want to, you know, take the Iron Throne. But there is a nice scene in the beginning where he's caught actually sitting on it. So he's perfect for this role. Paddy Considine, who I quite love, you know, I admire as an actor. I'm not sure if he's right. You know, he is supposed to be this meek, you know, weak ruler who, you know, has all the best intentions in the world. But there's just something about the dialogue that Paddy Considine's not connecting with. And I thought the costumes maybe looked a little bit silly. I wasn't convinced of his portrayal.
Yes, they all have the long white hair of the Targaryens. I like Paddy Considine. I thought his vulnerability, and even his physical vulnerability, he's sitting on the Iron Throne, which keeps injuring him and is obviously going to do him terrible damage.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, he keeps, I mean, the Iron Throne that we're dealing with here is a lot bigger. It's a lot more impressive than the Iron Throne in Game of Thrones. You know, there are rustier, there are dozens of more swords involved, and it keeps injuring him every time, as you say, that he sits down. I think Paddy Considine, you know, he does kind of maybe capture that vulnerability, but it sometimes felt as though the role of that king should have maybe even gone to an older actor. It's almost like, you know, he's kind of, you know, the way he's leaning forward and trying to portray an older king. I wasn't quite sure that he was right for the part. But I think that the female roles have worked an awful lot better. And in this first half, we should note that this is certainly a series of two halves, and that we're informed that once we reach, and this won't be a spoiler, but once we reach the second half of the series, there will be a huge time jump, which will allow Olivia Cooke, and which will also allow Emma D'Arcy to play Lady Alicent Hightower, and then also Princess Rhaenyra Targaryen. So for the time being, in the episodes that we watched, and certainly for the first installment, we're seeing young versions of these characters, and the young actresses playing them do a terrific job. I thought Millie Alcock as young Rhaenyra Targaryen, she's perfect. She captures that kind of teenage angst and that struggle that, you know, she wants to be one thing, but her parents expect, you know, but her parents expect another of her. And, you know, she's out there riding on top of dragons and, you know, wants to go off to battle, but her parents say, no, sit in the corner, read your book, and then when you come of age, marry. And I thought Millie Alcock was very good at this. And then also in the other corner, Lady Alison Hightower, who is the daughter of the King's Hand, has the same sort of problem in that she's being, you know, gently, but, you know, you see stubbornly pushed in this direction, where Hightower clearly wants, you know, to maybe take the throne himself and wants her to one day marry into the family. So she has to live a life that's been, you know, dictated by all of these powerful men in her life. And I just think the two girls in particular are the standout here. So themselves and Matt Smith, everyone else is a little bit hit and miss, I think.
Right. And do you think, you were saying in the original Game of Thrones, there's an awful lot of standing around and talking to each other. Is there more, is the dialogue more integrated into the action in this one?
A little bit, but it's very repetitive, Kay. I found it just quite... This is a thing to remember. Game of Thrones, at the best of times, could be very, very funny. And I think a lot of that had to do with, you know, both the writing and also the performers delivering that dialogue. And Peter Dinklage, in particular, was just a star when it came to, you know, employing and making the best of these very sarky, witty put-downs and one-liners. And, you know, he could just steal a scene with a single look or with a single insult. There's not an awful lot of that happening in House of the Dragon at the minute. And it's all very po-faced and very self-serious. And there is a sense that look, this if the first half of this season is just going to be all about this power struggle between Daemon and Viserys, if it's going to be all about the search for the next male heir, if everyone is annoyed because they can't live the lives that they're living, that's going to get very repetitive very quickly. And it does so even in the first hour. So what you need there is maybe a little bit of wit, maybe a little bit of cheek, maybe a little bit of humor, just to burst that serious bubble. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's been forgotten about. So and also as well, there's the makers have been talking about the fact that in this new season, we're in this new Game of Thrones era, we're not, there won't be any sexual violence depicted on screen. And they've talked a lot about, you know, ensuring that the violence isn't gratuitous, and also that the sex depicted, because sex was such a big part of Game of Thrones, it won't be gratuitous. I am not so sure about that.
I saw a brothel scene and there was no man naked. All the women were naked.
Exactly, exactly. And you see Matt Smith is just naked from the waist up. And even Matt Smith, which is a rarity for an actor promoting a series, you think they're going to say all great things about it. Matt Smith was speaking to Rolling Stone magazine and he said that he thinks there is probably a bit too much sex in House of the Dragon. We haven't even seen it. And he's saying, there were times where he was questioning, do we really need to do this? Do we really need to show this? And, you know, I'd have the same problem. At times, the sexual scenes in Game of Thrones, they were laughably over-the-top pornographic in their nature, and they often felt as though they were superfluous to the overall story. And already in the first episode, we're seeing that again, as well as the violence depicted. I think there's an awful lot of show and tell going on in the early episodes of House of the Dragon. It would be a much more powerful show if it didn't show us everyone losing their heads and their limbs and various other body parts. There were just things in that first episode, Kay, and I don't know if you felt the same way, that I really could have done without seeing.
Like the crab beating the man. Yeah, I could have done without that, I guess. So do you think you'll stick with it, Chris?
I think I'll stick with it purely because of that, of HBO saying that, you know, after episode 5, there will be this jump, because there's actually a 6-month jump between episode 1 and 2, and then there's a 2 or 3 year jump between episode 2, and it keeps getting bigger. So by the time we get to episode 6, we are going to see new faces introduced as older versions of the cast members. Some of the older ones will actually stick around, but there will be new characters, there will be new lead cast. So I am intrigued to see how that works, and I am interested to see Olivia Cooke and, as to say, Emma Darcy, who's terrific in those roles. The only thing is, that's 5 or 6 hours of television before we get there. That's an awful lot of waiting around with a very kind of, you know, underwhelming version of Game of Thrones. And that's the thing. And I know an awful lot of people will say that the first season of Game of Thrones, it took a while to grow into itself. We were in season 2 or 3 before we kind of got the show that everyone loved, before we got the show that was winning awards and picking up rave reviews. But the one thing that early season of Game of Thrones never was boring. And this series at times comes very close to just, you know, just being a very boring fantasy. And that's, I wasn't expecting that. I was expecting something better.
Well, Chris Wasser, thank you so much for watching that for us. House of the Dragon begins on Sky Atlantic at 2 a.m. next Monday. That's August the 22nd. It will be repeated at 9 p.m. that evening and will also be available to stream on Now. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Where there are people, there are stories. And that is especially true of Irish culture. Storytelling, this ancient form of entertainment, predates technology, television and radio. And perhaps its simplicity is what has given it such longevity as a form. From Homer to our own wandering Shanachie, the storyteller has held mythic status in countless global cultures. And now, in the 21st century Ireland, the revival of this art is being celebrated in the Listowel International Storytelling Festival, which takes place over 4 days next month. The festival is in its 4th year and back with in-person events after having to go online because of the dreaded COVID. I'm joined by Artistic Director of the festival, Maria Gillen, who is herself a storyteller. Maria, you're very welcome. There's a great connection to storytelling in Listowel. Eamon Kelly is considered Ireland's greatest Shanachie, I suppose, was born in Slievelucra and then taught in Listowel. Remind us about Eamon.
Oh, well, when you think of storytelling, Eamon is synonymous with that, and he was responsible for bringing storytelling to new levels and heights in the early days of television on RTE with Tales from the Fire. And a lot of his stories are still told at the Fla Ceoil of Éireann. So our young people cut their teeth on the stories of Eamon Kelly, which gives them new life, and they're as good today as they ever were. And of course, he was a renowned actor as well.
Yeah, let's listen to a clip from the master storyteller that was Eamon Kelly. I'd say this is one of these fireside storytelling sessions that he did for RTÉ. And in this, he's just preparing for his story.
My father never took off his hat, except when he was going into bed and into mass. And my mother said that he slept in the two places. At that time, every man covered his head. There was respect for the brain then, a delicate instrument. As well as covering the head, the hat is a handy receptacle. If you're cut short, you can give a feed of oats to a horse out of a hat. You can collect up apples in the orchard. You can bring in new-laid eggs out of the hay shed. You could nearly put a hen hatching in a hat. Well, a small hen, like a bantam or a guinea hen. Headgear gives a man authority. The popes and the kings and the bishops know this. They always cover their heads when they have something important to say. And where would the storyteller be without his hat when he sits by the fireside to tell a story?
That's the wonderful Eamon Kelly. Maria, I love all that business he goes into, even before he starts the story. The preamble gets as much care and attention as the story itself. Is that a feature of storytelling?
It is indeed, and it's a really important part of The Rambling House, because that is the time when you get a chance to have a look around and see who's coming in, who might have a song, who might have a story. And in the Rambling House of Listowel, they come in from Limerick, Kerry, Cork, all over. And that Rambling House has been going on for 50 years. And Eamon Kelly would cast his eye and the old word, giving them the bennu, you know. So you wouldn't be saying, you'll have a song now, or you'll be with a story. It was all done with a flick of the eyebrow and a deep look. You know, so Eamon was master of that, and a really good faratee, which is a different skill from being a storyteller.
Right. And when you come to telling a story now, do you start at the beginning of the story, or have you a way of getting somebody into a story?
I feel for storytellers as opposed to story writers, the dance with the audience is very important. So sometimes you might go out with an idea of telling these four stories. And when you come in contact with your audience, you find that other stories elbow their way to the front. And those are the stories that need to be told. And I'm very interested in the Banfasa stories and the way we can use, the resiliences of old in new ways and reconnect the generations through story.
Right. And tell me a little bit about that tradition of the Banfasa.
So I'm a drama therapist with my MA from Maynooth, and that's how I became interested in it. But I suppose when we were growing up, if my mother wanted to get a point across, she wouldn't state it in logic. She'd say it in a way that would nestle into your imagination, and you would find yourself following the path she'd laid out for you because of that. So it was easy words, you know, and we'd have the shanuckle for that, like, Crinig Nohoiga agus Chukigshi, mind the young people, and they'll come on. So it was knitted in to our way of being. And I suppose an example of that, I don't know if you'd remember, but during the 80s there, the electricity would go out on a regular basis because our grid was under pressure. And my mother would stick a candle into an old jam jar with dirt in it, and she'd say, if you stay now within the light of the candle, you'll be fine. But if you go into the shadows, I can't be responsible. And all five of us stayed where we could be seen, I can tell you, you know. So,
and when you're telling your story now, have you a set way of telling the story? Have you set phrases? Have you a set delivery? Or is that something that you kind of improvise? It's more like jazz.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. And it's almost like a precursor to jazz, because it has always been the way of the Shanachie to put a crack in my ear and story, to put a really good skin on the story. And a story that I would tell to a Cork audience would be very different from the same story that I would deliver to an audience in Texas, for example.
I thought you were going to say Kerry. The nearer you'd be to somebody, the way you'd have to vary it.
That's it. Well, it's true. And we're not that many miles away from one another, you know, but the way you'd think even of stories. So we have close connection with Coast to Coast Storytelling in America called Assist. And Sheila Arnold there challenged me to make a story, right is the wrong word, but to make a story about the dragonfly, which I based in Listowel. And you lean into things like the she, you know, the two tribes of fairies, the land fairies and the sea fairies, when you're imagining it. And when I'm looking at the River Feel, it is very different for me than looking at the Lee, say, in Cork. And different stories whisper into being, depending on where you are, because the environment is feeding your stories.
And again, there with Eamon, you know, there's you're very much in the farmyard, aren't you? And you're going into the hen house with your hat to put in the eggs or a sop of hay or whatever. What's your imagery then? Is it more contemporary or do you feed back into the past and the contemporary?
When I'm on story walks myself, observing the Banfasa tradition, you know, different things would come up in your mind. It could be fed almost unconsciously by what is in your zeitgeist at the time. So that's one way of getting stories. But another way that has been absolutely illuminating during COVID times was sitting down with people and going through the collective memories and co-creating stories. And they were a very different type of story, and they were a very enjoyable experience to make. We won the Bealtaine Hero Award for the stories that we made with elders. But it was also an amazing way of just being together. And, you know, in Ireland, we're very easy with the intergeneration population, you know, especially at an Irish session. And an example of that in Kerry recently is Sonny Egan, who won the All-Ireland FLA Storytelling for Kerry, representing Kerry. And then young Ryan Egan from Glenfisk down the road, 10 years of age, and he winning the All-Ireland FLA in his age group. And the photograph of the two of them together with their arms around one another would lift your heart, you know. So it's that's one of the things I love about stories, is that there is no there's no borders. It's the borderless land of telling stories.
Yes, and you've been all around the world, or else you've had people from all around the world at the festival in Listowel. I'm sure that are there comparisons, like, or is the range and the way people tell stories so completely different from the different countries?
The music of the language is different. It's like a song that is sung with the same words in an operatic way or in a folk way. You know, so we share a lot of stories, and people are really in love with the Irish stories and tell them everywhere we go. So I'm very proud, and I was very amazed at that. And just before coming here, I was telling stories with Baba C. He's an African-American teller, 70 years of age now, and been telling stories all his life. And he tells stories about Anansi, the spider. And that would be the wise character in the Afro-American stories. But there's so many similarities between the immigrant stories of the African-American and the Irish-American. You know, you just know they sat down around fires and told stories and sang songs to one another.
You have an interesting past in that you worked in the tech industry. Is there any marriage there between that tradition, more traditional form of storytelling, and technology?
Absolutely. And more that has been recognised. So even during COVID times, I was, running storytelling workshops for the likes of Adobe and Johnson Control. And even for ASA, the Union Groups of Ireland. Because how I ever got involved in storytelling as a profession was we were very interested in emotional intelligence and transactional analysis. And we found that that had a huge effect on the bottom line of the company, but also on the satisfaction of our customers and on the satisfaction of the people working for the organisation. And we went from a 70% brain drain to 0% to nobody leaving the company. And it was very small things, like people dislike being told, we're going to bring you out bowling on Thursday night, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. They much prefer to be asked, you know, and to have language in work like, how were you last night? So that they get to know one another on a deeper level than, we need to make this deadline, you know.
Now, the 2022 Listowel International Storytelling will take place on, from September the 15th to the 18th. You will be performing yourself at that.
I will. I can't wait. And we have amazing people from Ireland. So we have Liz Weir from the Armstrong Trust up in the hills of Antrim. And she's been awarded the MBE for services to storytelling for, you know, in terms of the peacemaking effort. We have Joe Brennan, who was on Nationwide on RTE during COVID, for picking up the telephone and telling stories to the elder isolated. And he's just a dote. I love him. And we have Ger Wolfe, the gorgeous Ger Wolfe, who was our first online performer on the online Rambling House during COVID. So we're very excited to have Ger Wolfe back. We have Maria Credalli, who's coming over from the UK. So she has Irish roots, but lives in the UK and tells wonderful lyrical stories. So we're looking forward to that.
Great.
And then, of course, we have the great plethora of fantastic homegrown Kerry talent like Sonny Egan, the current All-Ireland winner, Frances Kennedy, who's often on the afternoon show on RTE telling stories. And we have amazing
chiefly,
poets.
And chiefly yourself, Maria.
And myself. I'm looking forward to that as well.
So the 2022 Listowel International Storytelling will take place from September the 15th to the 18th. And for more information, visit kerrywritersmuseum.com. Our albums up for review this evening are Falling from Anna Malarkey. Anna Malarkey is a composer and performer from Galway. You may have heard her on with Sean very recently. As a performer, she weaves electronica with piano and voice. Having grown up in the west of Ireland, Anna draws inspiration from the sea for her music. Falling is Anna Malarkey's debut album and it reflects on love in all its forms. Next, we have Bleed Out from the Mountain Goats, an American band formed in 1991. In California by the singer-songwriter John Darnell. And for many years, he was the sole member of Mountain Goats. So we'll have to find out why. He has worked with a variety of collaborators over time, including bassist and vocalist Peter Hughes, multi-instrumentalist Annie Clark, also known as St. Vincent. Bleed Out is their 21st studio album. But we'll start with Freak Out release from Hot Chip, English synth-pop band formed in London in 1995. The band's second album, The Warning, in 2006 was nominated for the Mercury Prize. Their follow-up, Made in the Dark, 2008, included the single Ready for the Floor, which was nominated for the Grammy Award for Best Dance Recording. Freak Out release is their 8th studio album, so let's have a listen to the title track.
Wild Beast Freak Out release. Wild Beast Freak Out release. Wild Beast Freak Out release. Black Teeth Freak Out release.
Music used to be escape. Life's what you make it. I'm losing my taste for this feeling.
So Zara, Hot Chip formed in 1995, and that's a partnership between Alex Taylor and Joe Goddard. So that's pretty integral to the group, isn't it?
Yeah, they would always be the core partnership, and they have had a steady lineup for the whole way. And I think what's really impressive actually about this album and about Hot Chip is that they've managed to, they're one of the few bands who came up in 2006 that have managed to maintain the consistency that they have. And on this release as well, it's their eighth one, and it still is very good and it's very enjoyable to listen to. And as we heard at the top of that song, there's the lyric music used to be an escape. The lyrical side of this album I actually found very interesting, because I felt that as a fan we got to know them a little bit more intimately as well, and we got to hear about their anxieties and their depressions, and also their kind of lack of self-belief in their music, which is very fascinating, especially given how strong their career has been.
There's a lot of influences that they wear on their sleeve, isn't
big time.
There?
Oh, big time. And when you think that they are a band who have been around, as Zara said, since 1995, is that they've been through that whole phase, probably electropop or indie pop, they would have been described as, but they got sort of dancier as they went along, and kind of the bass got stronger and stronger. And I think that's sort of the great thing, is because they obviously went out and they bought some Soul Wax albums, they bought some Daft Punk albums, you know, and they've managed to bring in those influences. And what it does is every time they add a layer on musically, it makes the band better.
Right. And Zara, that poppy uplifting sound on many of the tracks, and then you say that kind of belies a more serious preoccupations this time.
Yeah. And I found, like, while the songs, as we heard there, they're really infectious and they're very euphoric, I did really enjoy this album while I was listening to it, but I did find that some of the hooks didn't actually stay with me so much. It was more so like the Easter eggs in here, which are in the lyrics. You know, there's references to The Shining, to Talk Talk. And I just found that the whole lyrical concept and through line in this was very strong and very impactful.
And what about you? Did you like this kind of dip into the darkness, or?
It's one of those things that it kind of works for me on occasion, because the last album they released is only about 3 years ago, called A Bath Full of Ecstasy, you know, and it was a huge, euphoric, pure dance floor sort of stuff. Whereas this time they have gone to explore sort of other topics. And I just felt that towards the middle of the album, it kind of makes the album dip. And while I'm interested in it, it's still, for me, it just kind of changed the flow of how it worked. But really strong at the start, dips for me a bit in the middle, but ends so well.
And what track stood out for you?
So probably my favourite, there's the collaboration they've done with Soul Wax, which is called Down. And then there's, I think it's the album closer, or it's towards the very end anyway, it's a track called Time, you know, and it for me is classic Hot Chip and really, really good.
Okay, let's listen to one of your choices there. This is the collaboration with Soul Wax, and this is Down.
Don't know how to break it all down.
be hard to keep off the floor with that one.
It would. And I really feel that that song kind of captures Hot Chips' like essence, but it doesn't make them sound like they're trying to sound like how they were back in the day and rejuvenate that. I think that they do sound like they're pushing forward, and with that song and also Eleanor as well, which is another kind of great Hot Chip moment. Yeah, so it's great.
So for stars out of five for you,
I'm going to give it, despite the dip in the middle, I think this is definitely worthy of 3.5 out of 5.
Three and a half.
And I want them to reopen Tripod again so we can go back to 2008 and hear those songs live.
And for you, Tara.
Yeah, I'm the same.
She's
with
very
Simon.
Demanding.
Yeah, very demanding. I'm the same. It's a 3.5 for me. I really enjoyed this.
It's a 3.5 for both of you, and that's for Freak Out Release from Hot Chip. Next, we have an Irish star, Falling, from Galway-based Anna Malarkey. Anna spoke to us earlier this month on Arena about her debut album, and it's an interesting mix of folk and electronica. Zara, recall Anna Malarkey and this kind of mix she does of folk and electronica.
Yeah, so she's Galway based, and before she delved into this project, she had been actually in a prog rock band for a number of years, and then she went on to work for like composing music for film and documentaries. And I think that that cinematic edge that she came from has really seeped into this very effectively, because here she blends two worlds and two eras almost together with very traditional sensibilities and timbres with barons and accordionas, and then she melds that with electronic music. And she does it really effectively, I think. And she has also a few songs which are sung a scuailge, which again works so nicely within this very ethereal and immersive world, because Irish is such a beautiful and rhythmic language that we don't really hear enough of. So I really, really admired her for this.
OK, let's listen to that opening track from Falling called Falling Apart. That's Falling Apart from Falling, Anna Malarkey's debut album. Simon, there is in the songs, there's either, you know, there's this folk and there's the electronica, and sometimes they merge perfectly together. Mm. And sometimes you think, oh, yeah, that's more the electronica, and then in another track, more the folk.
Yeah, it must have been an incredibly difficult. As even when I was listening to Anna talking to Sean, I was almost baffled by how do you arrange these things? How do you decide, I'd like that noise, you know, or how much of the electronic do I want? And probably for 75% of the album, for me, it works really, really well. And I think that the opening track on it is a prime example of where it works beautifully. But there's a couple of tracks later on where probably it's probably only a 10% more that you get. It's the dancier beat in the background. And for me, it just tends to start to drown itself out. You know, and it's one of those things that because her vocal is excellent and because all of the instrumentation is so good, is that I probably, when anything starts to drown out anything else, it dims the effect a little bit on this.
OK, so in that track there, you have her voice, you have the instrumentation, and then you have the mix.
Yes, you have the mix. And there are so many different things, and it's brilliant. I love listening to music where I have no idea what I'm hearing. You know, you can identify a guitar, you can identify a harpsichord or a drum or whatever it is, but when you're just listening to sounds and kind of going, that just adds to it. That just makes this even more, you know, of an interesting and a beautiful thing to listen to.
Yeah, she's very ambitious what her vision is. Love is the overarching theme on Falling, isn't it, Zara? In various manifestations, a lot of heartbreak, but also kind of love for her mother.
Exactly, yeah. So there's a song on Here Holding, which she described as being inspired by hearing about her mom's cancer diagnosis. And it was love from a point of view of being a pillar of support for someone. And that song, I felt, really stood out in terms of its arrangement. It stands out. It's very different from the album. And in that way, it kind of really brings you back into the album. And it's very effective. It's very poignant. And then, as we heard in the previous song, she sings, "I'm hopelessly in love with you," you're not worth my time anymore. I'm thinking of The Upside Down, which was a song that's, as listeners might have heard there, The Upside Down is a note to Stranger Things. It's all about falling in love in another dimension, which again fits with that kind of otherworldly soundscape that she's building. And it is, you know, the songwriting is fine. I do think that that is one of the components of the album that slightly lets it down a little bit.
The
lyricism, mm-hmm. more so. I think that there's definitely plenty of time, as this is just a debut, she's plenty of time to perfect that and work upon that, because there's so many strong ideas here and she's doing everything so well.
This was recorded in The Beekeepers in County Clare, which is run by Dohi O'Draine. Mm. And there is very much, it's not his sound, but you can get the kind of world they're trying to build. Yeah. It's not dissimilar.
There's definitely a kinship for sure. And before I had found out that detail, his music did come to mind, and as well, like Elaine May, who Dahi works with as well sometimes. I do think that there is a great resurgence of this very interesting mix of traditional and electronic, which I really hope continues to prosper.
Yes. And again, we were talking about the way she writes and sings in Irish. And Ishka, I think, is based on an Ulan Ni Gonal poem.
Yeah.
So that works very well.
Oh, it does. Yeah. And, you know, what was amazing was I was listening to both it and to Douse and Wow, you know, and mm-hmm. not having a rashers what I was listening to, you know. But just as you said, the stuff sung and spoken in Irish just sounds so good anyway. And it made me go and find out. So when I came to Douse and Wow, I found out that it was a song about her granny.
Yeah.
You know, and her granny being picked up for a date and going out. And it just, they're just such a, it's such a beautiful storytelling language, and she gets that mix right.
Now, for Anna Malarkey's Falling, stars out of five from you, Zara.
I thought this is a really impressive debut. Definitely some work to go for future releases, but this is a nice 3.5 for me.
And from you, Simon.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, this is a really good, and it's something I would look forward to album number two. So 3 out of 5.
Great. Mountain Goats is the next one. It's a group that have had a 28-year career, and this is their 21st studio album. But is there only one of them?
Essentially, yes. Is that there's some bands that you have to have. It's all about the layers and the different people and everything that they bring.
Did they all fight?
I don't even think that it's necessarily that they fight. I think it's more that he's just not interested in the band structure. Mm. John Darnell is not that interested. He's interested in having people around who work with whatever it is that he feels like he's doing at the moment.
Oh, a band is not a democratic thing.
Oh, God, no.
In his world. No. Okay.
No, it's very much about the front man here. Mm. And the albums tend to be inspired by something that he has decided that he'd like to talk about. And it just so happens on this occasion that he's been stuck in a basement for a long time during lockdown one. And he watched an awful lot of old action movies where the theme was vengeance, you know, and he became very interested in both the execution in both senses of the word, but also in the fruitlessness of revenge as well. And that's where the album came from.
Is this a concept album?
Yes, are long gone, you know. This is definitely a concept album, and it's definitely around a theme, you know, and it takes it from everything, you know, from the very start, which is a training montage, right the way through all manner of various executions and revenge plots, you know, and it's based on what he was watching at the time. But he became obviously fascinated by not just the plots themselves, but by everybody's looking for redemption in revenge, and they know they're never going to find it.
Okay, let's listen to Training Montage, and I'm going to listen out for all that you've said and see what movie he was watching.
Water dripping from the pipes down in the basement, bare feet on a concrete floor, notches on the wall of my solitary cell, sweat dripping out of every pore. It feels like it takes forever. It's maybe 5 minutes on screen, but the horns will swell and the strings will sound when that flipped quarter hits the ground.
That was Training Montage from Bleed Out, from the Mountain Goats. So, Zara, I don't think you're as familiar maybe as Simon is with the Mountain Goats. So could you pinpoint the movies, or was that important? Or is it more tropes from movies he's talking about?
Yeah, no, I am also not very good with movies. So I only got John Rambo in one of the songs that stood out to me. But yeah, I had not really gone too deep on the Mountain Goats. And I think it was just because a case of, you know, this is the 21st album, there's so much to listen to, and I'd always appreciated that they're very good and a lot of my friends are big fans. I was just a little bit intimidated, I guess, but for anyone who is in a similar position, I do think that this is actually a brilliant entry point, because as we heard there, the opening suite of the songs are very kind of like classic rock, but then there's also some really nice like dusty Americana, there's some nice country stuff, and then there's really pretty stuff. And you know, we were talking about the structure of the band and how it's mostly John. I think it's just because he works as well so quickly, and we hear that as well, like he'll write a song and just immediately want to record it, and we hear that really nicely in the last song, which is the title track as well. I think it's called Bleed Out, where it's him and it's a soft instrumentation, and we hear him at one point actually turning a page as he's singing the lyrics. So that brought about a really nice intimacy. So that for me, as someone coming to this new, really welcomed me into the world of the Mountain Goats and interested me a lot.
Okay, Simon, a good introduction. Overall, what did you think?
Yeah, no, I thoroughly enjoyed this, but probably I've probably watched too many Death Wish movies over the years, so that probably helps. But I'm going to give this 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 from Simon. And from you, Zara?
This is a really strong 3.5 again for me. I really enjoyed it and can't wait to go back to it.
Okay, the three albums were Bleed Out from the Mountain Goats, Anna Malarkey's Falling, and Hot Chip Freak Out Release. And Zara Hederman and Simon Marr, thank you so much. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan.